while. So I want to just, we'll just get started here. And to give an idea, a general overview of what I'm going to be talking about today. Louder? Okay. That's hard. So to give a general idea of what I'm going to be talking about today, I want to hit on this idea. It's kind of coming from a lot of psych theories are starting to come together with neurobiology and a sense of how do we view the person, how does the person develop over time, and to this notion of mentalization. And so I'll get a little bit more into what that is, but I want that to be the focus of what I talk about tonight. And with that, I want to mainly couch it in a developmental sense at first. So I want to talk about communication. I want to talk about marriage and couples and how do we do this well. But I actually want to start from the very beginning and build up a sense of how do we get there and what might go well and what might not go well as we do get there in life. So as I present, you know, it might be helpful to think a little bit about how certain things I talk about around development, how you experienced those growing up. What it was like as a small child, if you can remember, up to, you know, where you're at now. How is this presented in your marriage? How is this presented with siblings and parents and friends and so on? And not asking for a huge deep dive, a huge soul search as I go, but really just enough so that you kind of get a sense of where do I stand in my capacity to mentalize, to communicate with other people? Am I doing okay with that? Am I not? Where do I need to work on it? So just a very general sense of that. And so to start, what am I talking about with this whole idea of mentalization? If you're familiar with Aristotle, if you're familiar with Thomas Aquinas, there's the idea of metacognition. You think about thoughts. You think about your own mind. You can even sort of hold a reflection of your mind in mind. And you get a sense of what am I about? What am I? What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Well, if we take that into the social world, starting with infants and building up gradually into a more robust form from there, what we see is something that's actually very rich, very enjoyable, that really is kind of the essence of what we do with other people when we're really deeply, truly interacting with them. So what mentalization is then, taking this idea of metacognition, is I can hold in mind my own thoughts, emotions, motivations, intentions, and so on and so forth, the things that happen inside of me, and also the things that happen outside of me, and see how they relate, to what's present, see how they relate to what I'm projecting into the future and what I've experienced in the past through memories. And I do the same thing for other people. I can look at somebody and starting with a series of automatic processes that I don't have a lot of control over, I'm going to start looking at what's the prosody of their speech. Are they speaking quickly? Are they speaking loudly, quietly? Are they comfortable? Are they uncomfortable? Where are their eyes? What are they looking at? Are they looking at me? Are they looking down, away, left, right, up in their head? I'm watching their body language. Are they closed up? Are they wide open? And I'm not having to think about this in any sort of explicit way. I'm not going, gee, he's sitting there with his arms wide open and he's looking right at me and he seems really comfortable right now. You don't have to do that. This happens in less than a second. This is what the visual component of your brain, it's breaking it apart into a bunch of pieces and putting them back together in less than a second and giving you all this information. But you need more than that automatic process, because then you actually do need to step back and go, how am I feeling? And is this my own emotion? Is this coming from the other person? What's happening here? What's going on around me? What's led to where we're at right now? And what does that tell me about the other person? Because I also want to keep in mind the three things, you know, I'm going to keep harping on are, what are their thoughts? What are their emotions? And what are their motivations? What are their intentions? What are they aiming at? And so how do we go about developing this capacity? Well, you know, a child in utero is, they're starting to interact with the world a little bit, actually. If mom's stressed, if mom's generally happy, it's starting to imprint the child and how they're going to interact with the world the second they're born. And then a child's born, hopefully put into mom's arms right away, maybe breastfed, and that's the beginning of these interactions. And they gradually pick up speed from there. First, a child, you know, within a few weeks is capable of making eye contact, and they giggle a little bit. They start to look at you. They They look at mom. They start to signal to mom with their eyes and, of course, with their cries too. That's the very first language that an infant has. And when they do that, so long as the parent is sufficiently attuned, they more or less get what they need. Not perfectly, not every time, you know, a great match, but a good enough match of baby cries, mom runs through the list. Do they need a diaper? Are they cold? Are they hot? Do they need to sleep? Are they overstimulated, understimulated? Are they hungry? And, you know, you start to hit those. And as you get to know this baby, you don't have to go through this list quite so much because you kind of have a sense. They might even have special cries that they develop. We fast forward a little bit to around, let's say, 9 months, and a baby could do quite a lot with their eyes. They can look at you and they can make you laugh. They can show you what it is that they want. They can express their emotions a great deal. And also, they're getting a lot from your eyes as you look at the baby. So one of the things we see in a child of 9 months is they can tell someone who's a reliable, helpful adult from someone who isn't, who's normally truthful, not in the sense of facts, learning, school stuff, but truthful in the sense of when I look to this person, things that seem to make sense happen. When I look to mom and express a need, she does the things that fulfill my needs. When I look at dad and he's teaching me the animal sounds, cow actually goes moo. Cow doesn't go oink. And it makes sense. And when a child sees that an adult isn't dependable in that way, they attend less to that adult. And this is already at 9 months. They don't have any language. They don't have explicit thoughts yet. All this is happening at a very emotional level, at a very immediate present level, at the level of skin and thought and emotion and very implicit interactions between the adults or even other children around this baby and the baby. Fast forward from there a little bit more, and we're in the toddler years, of course, and now we're dealing with big emotions, we're dealing with desires, we're dealing with the fact that I very much want something and I can do things to make it happen. Mom's in the kitchen, I want mom, mom's not coming, I cried, I did the thing, I looked, mom's not here, I just crawl and I grab on mom and mom gets really angry because she doesn't want to do this right now. But I can very much show this is what I want. And then I see, does mom give it to me or not? And I have big emotions about that. I might feel really great. I might not feel so great, and I might start crying. But this interchange is gradually forming this capacity to have a mind that you can reflect on and see that other people also have minds that they can in turn reflect on and that you can reflect on them as well. And it's building up the capacity to have conversation, which I think to view in this perspective, we can really look at as a kind of game. When a conversation is going well, I volley the ball at you and you do something with it. If you just catch the ball and go, great toss, the game stops. There's no game. But if you throw the ball back at me and then I throw the ball back to you and we keep going, there's a volley. We're having a game. This is fun. This is enriching. Maybe sometimes not. We might be having a fight. But it doesn't matter because we're communicating. We're doing this deeply social, human thing. Well, part of how a child gets here, the child doesn't mentalize, but who does mentalize? Mom and dad, older siblings, other adults in the family. These people can mentalize. So, yes, there's the baby cries, you feed baby, baby's better. That's important. But there's another important step. It's this idea of mirroring. What mirroring is there's two steps. There's a contingent step, which is kind of just a bizarre psych term for it, and there's a mark step, and I'll explain those. So contingent is baby's crying, and I notice that baby's crying, and I go, oh, you're sad. You're so sad. If I stay there, that does no good for baby. Now I'm sad and baby's sad, and that's kind of freaky for a little one. Like, wow, I just made mom sad. I can do that. Now mom isn't available. I'm not getting any needs met, and this isn't so good. But if mom can go, oh, look, you're so sad right now. It's okay. I'll help you. And mom picks the baby up. That's the marked part. What that really means is contingent, I have a sense of where you're at, and I accurately, more or less, most of the time, reflect that back to you. And so you know, okay, mom's got it. But then the marked part is I mark that. I notice what's happening, but then I notice what's happening in me, and I make it my own. Now, some of the tricky things is maybe baby's crying and mom starts to get ratcheted up, or dad. But, you know, that's okay because you can mark that and say, well, baby's ratcheting me up. I'm also the adult in the room. I'm going to take a step back, try to calm down for a moment, and then I'll readjust, and I can come back, and I can bring back the game. And that's what this contingent in Mark does. If you want to think about it, babies volleyed something back at you. You take the ball. That's the contingent part. I'm playing the game. I recognize that you've done this action towards me. Now, after that, what am I going to do? And that's when we mark properly. We volley it back in a way that the baby can receive. Or the toddler, and as we get older, what we start to mark and play with gets a lot bigger. It's not simply very tiny wants and big emotions, but emotions that aren't necessarily expressing a lot of meaning out in the world. To the child, they are. I'm sad. Everything in me is sad right now. But what does that mean to the world? Not as much yet, but the child starts to get 3, 4, and on and on and on. Now what's happening is there's a lot there. I have things that I want to communicate to you. I have desires and wants. I have complex ideas. I want to negotiate. I want to get something out of this exchange, and I want to give something to you as well. And so when we play the game of contingent marked relations, I mean, that's just what we're doing. We're playing a game. We're making this enjoyable, enriching. We're going back and forth. So what might this look like, you know, as you get into the teenage years? Well, now we have the big emotions again, but we have also tied with that sexuality, romance, plans for the future, a sense of independence, a sense of individuality. Where am I going? What can I do? What am I capable of? It's a lot. It's a lot of things that we need to see in ourselves, we need to communicate to other people, and we need to have that mirrored back to us in a way that we can digest it, we could play with it. So if a teen comes to mom and dad, starts talking about their big ideas, their hopes and their dreams for life, and they just get a, "You sound really excited," nothing more, what do they do with that? Not only is the conversation ended, but think about also the emotional impact on that. Gee, what I'm thinking about might not be that important. Maybe I can't make much of an impact. Maybe I'm not a very capable person. Maybe I'm not a very lovable person. And that can quickly start to unwind. But similar to the younger years, when mom and dad go, "Wow, that's great. You sound really excited. Tell me more about that." I don't have to say in some super explicit way, "I'm very curious about you right now. Please tell me more." The phrase says it enough. That's great. Tell me more. This doesn't have to be big things. It's enough to go, "Wow, mom and dad care. They're paying attention. They're listening to me." And I can go on. And then you can start giving each other feedback. You could talk a lot more. So how about now, you know, older, you're married, you've been together maybe for a while. Let's hope that all these things have come into place enough. You have a more or less secure attachment with your spouse. There's a sense in which there isn't a whole lot of anxiety about, are my relational needs to be admired, to be seen, to be loved, to have my love received. These are more or less getting met enough. So what might this look like? Well, on the positive side, I don't know, husband comes home from work and goes, "I got the promotion." And the wife goes, "That's great. Tell me about it." It's awesome. Like, we can do so much more. I'm going to make all this much more money. We're in a much better spot. All these things we've been worrying about, they're gone now. Wow, that's really great. And, you know, they can just keep it going. On the other hand, as I noted before, if it's great, look away, I'm going to go attend to the kids now, that's demolishing. I come in, I'm ecstatic, I'm feeling great, I'm feeling big, on top of the world, and now I'm not. I've been completely flattened. Because there's no response to give me a sense of, where am I standing within this social picture with other people? Who am I? What am I feeling? Are the things that I'm feeling, do they actually make any sense with the world around me? Versus, you know, you get that response and suddenly you can open up a lot more. You can identify more with what's going on inside of you. You can start to see what's going on inside of them. It's great. Now, take something negative on the other hand. Spouses are having a fight. Husband's been a jerk for the last few hours. Wife notices something happened that usually kind of makes him mad. And he's just sort of raging. She goes, "You seem really mad right now." "I'm not mad." You actually do seem mad. And I noticed that thing happened earlier. And you don't usually like that. And I'm not trying to be mean here, but you've been kind of a jerk to me and the kids for the last hour, and you've been kind of just raging and stomping around the house. Well, what that is the contingent response. It's, I see you and I've communicated you back to you. Maybe the husband goes, yeah, you're right. I'm angry. And now it's time for the mark. That's okay. What do you need right now? Do you need me to listen? Do you need me to help you fix this? Do you need a minute alone? Just let's figure out what you need. Now it's marked. We've entered the play again. Well, what I need is to get away for a little bit. Okay, game's over for a little while. He walks away, but he's walking away feeling she saw me. She got where I'm coming from. She met my need to be seen, to help me calm down, to help me feel in myself again. Because really what's going on when we start to get ratcheted up, when we start to get very anxious, we're not really feeling too much in ourselves. Because what shuts down in regards to this idea of mentalization when we're ecstatic or we're incredibly sad and sort of demolished, when we're incredibly anxious, when we're terrified, mentalization, that capacity to reflect on ourselves and others, goes down dramatically. And it doesn't just go down in the sense of I'm not as aware of this, but the brain regions that actually allow us to do this also start to go down. They're not as active. Other areas of the brain that are based more on immediate action, figure out what to do right now without much thought, without much reflection, those start coming online. We start treating things like they're terrifying, like we're meeting a bear in the woods instead of my spouse and my children. And really, so when the spouse has met the husband in this case, what she's done is she's helped all that to kind of quiet down again. And he can get back to a place where he can reflect. And he can also then hopefully mentalize and go, I've been a real jerk. And yeah, that did tick me off. And I'm really sorry. And I hope you forgive me. There, like he saw her pain. He marked her pain. She gets to walk away feeling like a human being, feeling like she's been noticed. And great. The game can stop here. The game doesn't have to go on permanently all the time. Play a game of volleyball. It's great for an hour or so. You don't want to play it your entire day. That's exhausting. And there's other parts of life. This isn't all of life, but it's an important part of life. It's an enjoyable and meaningful part of life. Now, I brought up this idea of secure attachment a moment ago. I don't want to harp on this too long. There's a lot that could be said on it. But in these early years, as we're being mirrored or not mirrored, as the case might be, we're gaining these working models of what I can expect first from the people around me and then from the world. So a more generalized thought of what I expect things to look like. You have someone who's secure, they come at other people and they know not everyone's nice. People can be jerks, people can take advantage of you. But there's kind of an implicit trust of, I can tell when someone's being more or less on the level with me, and I can tell when they're not, and I more or less know how to act accordingly, and I'm not going to get overwhelmed by this. And so I'm probably not going to get ratcheted up to the point where I can't really think anymore. But maybe things in development aren't so good. So you get someone who's in fact maybe much more anxious. The care they were given, the mirroring they were given, it didn't at a good enough level reflect where the child actually was at. The child's mad, and mom starts treating the baby like he's sad, or the toddler, and okay, like, you missed me, you're not getting it. That's very frustrating. Now, when I work with little kids, I try to be very careful about what I reflect back to them about what they're saying, because if you get it wrong, you're done. They don't want to listen to you anymore. It's just, their trust with, I mean, I'm not mom or dad, so the trust with me can be very easily broken. With mom and dad, there's almost infinitude, great deal more of trust there and willingness to keep going and keep trying. But if day after day, parents are being intrusive or they're not giving enough care, they're not getting it right at a good enough level, which is maybe somewhere around like 60-40, and actually, you want to get it a little bit wrong, because when you get a little bit wrong, then the child or the teenager or your spouse can say, you got that wrong. I'm not actually mad right now. I'm sad. And so long you go, oh, okay, great. Okay, we can move on. That's no big deal. But in the early years, you can't really do that so much. And a lot of times these parents are preoccupied with their own concerns, with their own past. Maybe they're poor. Maybe they're preoccupied with the budget. Maybe they're preoccupied with the fact that their boss is a jerk and they're afraid of getting fired. But what's happening is the child isn't getting their needs that actually allows them to build up a secure, confident sense of self. You have other people who tend to be, well, actually before I go there, so what does this anxious person look like in adulthood and relationships? They're constantly chasing the mirroring. They're constantly asking the spouse to confirm them, to affirm them, to show back to them, what am I feeling? When they see the spouse as angry as they talk, they start to assume maybe I've done something wrong, or maybe I'm angry, or maybe I'm sad now. And they're not able to actually mark inside, how am I actually feeling? They're getting it too much from the outside world because they don't have the capacity to get that from within. We have other people who, in similar environments, but based on as these sort of unconscious decision trees are made that form our attachment styles, become more avoidant, dismissing. What that means is their tendency is to, when this attachment system gets activated and they want touch, they want closeness, they want mirroring, they're actually really good at shutting it off. Now, what doesn't get shut off is a sense of anxiety, terror, fear. That's actually going, but you just can't see it because they keep blank and they focus on other things. And what this leads to in adulthood is going to be an adult who isn't chasing after mirroring at all. Because a secure person's going to want mirroring every once in a while. They're going to want someone to show them themselves and meet them where they're at. And all these normal terms that we have a general implicit sense of what they mean. But the avoidant person's not going to really care about that, especially as that gets more and more severe. Their care is about work. It's about success. It's about doing the next thing or thinking the next thought. Their capacity to actually reflect on themselves and the spouse is very limited by anxiety, but also by a sense of, I'm not really familiar about the things that I feel and the things that I think, unless maybe they're very intellectual or they're very concrete. They're the concrete details of my job. Outside of that, I don't get it. This is where you get the spouse who, you know, one spouse is sad. They just go, well, why don't you just go do this? Like, yeah, that's going to go over really well. When you've been told, why don't you just go do this after you're having a complex situation that you know isn't easy to resolve, that you have a great deal of feeling about, and that's all the response you get, you usually kind of lose confidence in the other person. So this is the spouse who's often just jumping to that, jumping to solutions, jumping to thoughts. They don't get it. Whereas the anxious adult is just so preoccupied with the sense of I'm afraid and I'm not getting what I need that this anxiety overrides their capacity to reflect and get an idea of where am I, what am I doing, why am I doing it, and where is my spouse, and the same system going on for them. And so these kind of problems that can then develop in communication, because ideally what you'd like to see in a marriage is spouses can talk about this. They can share their own motivations and thoughts and emotions, have it received by the other person who's going to reflect on it and spit it back at them, and they're going to have a good, useful conversation. That stops when there's not a secure attachment. There can be a certain level of mentalization and of dialect, you know, a certain dialectic of back and forth, but it tends to be very limited, and it tends to be very prone to ruptures where now the relationship feels over, or we're angry at each other, we're going to steam for a few hours or a few days. Where someone who's secure, that's generally not going to be a problem. On the other hand, something that's a bit more universal of an experience, whether you're securely attached or insecurely attached, is if you're very anxious, if you're very elated and super happy, if the emotions are really kicking up a great deal, there's just a lot going on inside of you. There's a lot of noise, and that reflective capacity has gone down. That might happen in a moment. Spouse comes home, they're super happy, you're actually super angry because the kids have been crazy all day, and you're just at your last wit with it, and they go, I've had a great day, just kind of an explosion, you've missed me, I've missed you, things aren't going well. That's going to happen every now and then to the best of couples. It's fine, you can deal with that. You can come back to this stance of seeing each other and apologize later and work it out. But when there's something more prolonged, we've hit huge financial difficulties, someone's sick, we have a child maybe with special needs or who's ill. Maybe a spouse is cheated or has an issue with things online. Maybe work is just taking a little bit too much of the space at home and there isn't a lot of relating to each other right now. Well, if within these problems there's actually a great deal of emotion, sadness and anger and anxiety, this is going to shut down. You're not going to be able to think about yourself, about the other person, whether you're securely attached or insecurely attached. It's just not going to work very well. So this kind of gets to the second part of what I wanted to talk about, which is kind of establish a general sense of what is this mentalization thing. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I need to ask a question because I'm not clear before you go on to the next. Securely versus insecurely attached. I guess I'm not quite sure where that fit into the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is that something that happens for a child when things are done well when they're little? And then if it wasn't done well when they were little, for example, they weren't breastfed, then the likelihood that that doesn't happen later, I don't mean breastfeeding, but that doesn't happen later is minimized?
Yeah.
I'm a little lost.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So securely attached, the sense of this confidence that comes about, yes, when things have gone well enough in childhood. Not perfectly, doesn't have to be perfect, but a well enough sense of, I have a sense of who I am, what I'm about, who are the people around me, what are they about, how do we relate to each other. We can talk, we can enjoy each other, we can fight with each other, and we can come back to a sense of well-being. I can quickly come down from a sense of anxiety because I've internalized from mom and dad and from the people who love me these messages of, it's going to be okay, things are going to work out, someone can help me, I can help myself even, I can calm myself. With the insecure attachments, there's a lot less of that. Now, like I said, I don't want to make a huge deal of those, but it's important to consider because if you do have more of an insecure attachment, this is going to be a lot harder. The capacity to mentalize is necessarily a bit wounded because you don't have a great reflection of yourself back to you. Well, a child gets their sense of self first from the environment, first from mom and dad, and also the things that they're feeling, but they're not thinking in language yet. We're not thinking about who am I and what am I about and what am I going to do next. So that needs to come from a careful back and forth with the environment, with the parents. And when that hasn't established, all these things, this capacity to reflect, isn't going to be as strong. Now, some people are going to get some strength from other places. You have a good teacher, you have a good coach, you have good friends, or maybe it doesn't come till later in life. You have a really good spouse and you start to become securely attached to them and you start to develop something a lot healthier. And so as you develop something healthier, this capacity to reflect and reflect accurately enough to play the game of keeping the conversation going is going to strengthen over time. So that's essentially what we're looking at there. And
So for the person, yeah. You're talking about secure attachments in a person.
Yes.
And they're securely attached to people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and also to themselves. There's a sense that they're securely attached to the people in their lives, their spouses, their siblings, so on. But also a sense of, I'm securely attached to myself. I could pay attention and reflect. I can, in a moment of some anxiety before it gets too bad, just to use that as an example, I can start to go, why? What am I feeling and why am I feeling this way and how did I get here? Okay, like things aren't going so hot right now. I really just screwed up at work and my boss is going to ream me out. Okay, well, I can accept it. I can just apologize. I can try to make it better. I'm not a complete idiot. I'm going to go back to doing my job. This is going to be okay. It'll blow over in a couple days. We all might say that to ourselves. But to the person who's securely attached, they're actually going to believe it. They're going to, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to be okay. And so they're going to have butterflies in their stomach for a few days. The boss is finally going to let off his steam. They're actually probably going to feel a little bit relieved. And we're going to go on. So I'm secure with myself. I can give this message to myself, and I can believe the message to myself. And then I can get it reinforced because I'm securely attached to the people around me. And I have enough people in my life who themselves are also securely attached enough that they're going to fuel me back up for when I go back into the world. typically for people who are insecurely attached, they tend to attract to people who are insecurely attached. If you're insecurely attached, well, guess what? Your mother and father are insecurely attached. Your grandparents are probably insecurely attached, and so on, probably a few generations back. The sins of the father fall into the seventh generation. You know, this stuff takes a while to sort of to work out. And chances are the people who you can feel comfortable with are going to be people who are going to be a little bit more like you. So your friends are probably also going to be less securely attached, and so you're not going to get fed and fueled as much as you might need from the outside world to feel like these relationships are good enough, that they're safe, that you can be generally calm, that you can return to a sense of baseline calm and enjoyment, confidence. I'm not talking about huge confidence, just a sense of, I'm a generally capable guy. I can do the things I need to do. Not a big deal. And in yourself, you're not very strongly attached to yourself either. You can't give yourself these messages and actually believe them. This is a source of anxiety disorders, personality disorders, depressive problems. You start to tell yourself, it's going to be okay. This is going to blow over. My boss is going to yell at me. And the feelings don't die down. A sense of calm and peace and eventual return to enjoyment don't come back for days, for weeks, for hours, for years. You can't believe these messages. In fact, you're very likely to start counteracting these messages. No, my boss actually probably thinks I'm an idiot. I have probably about two more strikes left and I'm going to be fired. Because I'm going to be fired, I'm going to be destitute because then I can't pay the bills and this sucks. So I'm going to go home. I'm going to rage at my children. I'm going to rage at my wife. And then I'm going to look at my poor wife and go, I really need you to show me the best of myself right now. And guess what? She's not going to want to because you're just a jerk. But you don't mean to be a jerk because you're just flipping out a little bit. And it's not going well. So yeah, when I talk about this capacity to reflect, to mentalize, these are the kinds of things that get in the way of that. Because what we perceive and how we perceive it, the meaning we give it, the meaning we communicate it with it is not so readily believed. It does not have easy impacts on us that can bring us back to a sense of baseline. And it generally leads to extra problems over time because you come home like that too many days in a row and it's going to start eroding the marriage. And that's going to start affecting the kids. Kids are going to be too quiet. Got to watch out for the kids who are a little too well-behaved. Or the kids are maybe going to be a little bit too crazy. Now, guess what? You're not doing as well at work. You're not doing as well with your spouse. You're not doing as well with the kids because everything's going wrong around you. And that's going to spin out of control to a certain degree. It might be a very loud spinning out of control. A lot of fighting. Maybe you do lose a couple jobs. Maybe your kids start getting into some real big trouble, drugs and criminal stuff. It might be a very quiet, slow, simmering, none of us are actually very happy. None of us are really okay with this. And none of us are able to talk about it. And when we talk about it, nothing good really comes of it. Or if we actually manage to eke out a sense of understanding and a sense of moving on, it doesn't last. It just eventually dissipates and falls flat. And the best of couples, even when there is that secure attachment to the self, to your spouse, to the children, that can still be swayed a bit in times where things aren't so good. Like I said, maybe to elaborate on a little more, your spouse is sick. Maybe it's something really bad. It's going on for months. They're not going to be able to feed you. They're not going to be able to mirror the best of you. And also the worst in a way that allows you to work out problems. You're going to become a little less attached to yourself. I'm not thinking about attached in like the theological sense of too attached, but just a sense of I'm feeling what I'm feeling. I can reflect on it. I can work with the things that are going on in here and with the things that are going out in there, and it's okay. That's going to start eroding with stress, sleepless nights, the stress that puts on your relations, on your children. It's going to be a lot harder to get a sense of where's the other person at and to have these conversations. You're going to become exhausted. The sixth spouse is going to become exhausted because even if they're securely attached, you're going to see that if I wasn't sick, my family wouldn't be suffering in this way. And of course, everyone around them knows it's not your fault. You didn't choose to get sick. But we do that. We blame ourselves. We start to attack ourselves a bit and things start to erode. And so these same problems can emerge even in a couple that's very strong. Other things tend to lead to this quite often, or the finances are not going so hot. You didn't do anything wrong. Business is just slow, or you got laid off from your job. Didn't do anything wrong at all, just too many people, you have to go. And so it just stresses out the family. We don't do well under stress. We get stressed and our joints start to balloon out. We get inflamed. The processes in our own brain aren't going so well because we're not getting the neurotransmitters that we need that keep us focused and attentive and regulated. We're not sleeping well. We're not eating well. Some of that's a matter of choice, but some of that's a matter of just this thing isn't working like it should be working. And that's when things start to break down. So, coming to what do we do with this? What do we do with this if my spouse and I are not securely attached? Or what do we do with this if we're going through one of those problems, whether it's a huge one or we're just going through maybe a briefer period, but things aren't so good? How do we go about this mentalizing thing, this reflecting in a way that lends itself to problem solving and conversation and enjoyment and intimacy, closeness? Well, one of the first things we could do is, this is all stuff that if you've read any book on couples therapy, if you've ever been in couples therapy, these are the basics, but they're the basics because they work. And this is what people implicitly do when things are working well. So you start with I statements. You're not saying you did that, you are going to do this, you need to do that. You start with I. I'm having the reflection. I'm the subject of this communication. I'm letting you know that what's coming out of me are my reflections, my emotions, my thoughts, what I'm taking away from this and what I'm seeing in you. You also want to use softer language, more conditional language. Not you always, or I always see you doing this. But I've noticed this. I wonder if this might be going on. Things haven't been so great lately. I think maybe this is what's happening. And then you can elaborate on it. It doesn't have to be long. We don't have to be writing paragraphs here. And we're also avoiding the absolutes. The you always, you never, I always, I never. That doesn't do anyone any good. There's hardly ever an absolute kind of situation. And once you've delivered this, honestly, just check in. How does that sound to you? What do you think about what I just said? Did that seem like that was accurate? Am I missing something? Is that kind of what's happening here? And then shut up. Just shut up and listen. Listen to your spouse. And if they're quiet, give it a minute. Give it 2 minutes. Be quiet. Try not to freak out. And just wait. Wait them out for a moment. And then let them talk. And when they talk, really think about what they're saying. If they correct you, take the correction. At least take it at first. You can always come back around. Because guess what? You're married to this person. So the problem's going to come around again. It's this great dictum in therapy. I don't have to point out everything a patient does because the things that matter are going to happen over and over and over again. The things that we fix aren't the little one-off things. Those don't bring people into therapy. The things that bring people into therapy are the things that they do over and over and over and over again that they don't recognize, that they don't see. So your spouse goes, I'm not mad. Hear him out. Accept it. Who cares? They don't think they're mad at the moment. This doesn't have to be the moment where you go, I think you are. I kind of actually think you are. Now, tomorrow, spouse comes storming in again, yelling at the kids and throwing things or whatever. I think you're mad. And here's why I think you're mad. Because you're throwing things. And I'm not trying to pin you to the wall. Can we just talk about it for a moment? And then you can come right back to the same system. Talk about it. Say your piece. I know yesterday you said that you weren't actually mad about this, but you yelled at the kid just now, and an hour ago you yelled at me, and when you went to get changed after you came home from work, you slammed the door pretty loudly, and I heard your drawers kind of going back and forth, which isn't your usual style. I I think you're mad. I actually think you might be angry, and I think this is why. I'm not saying you're always angry. I'm not saying you're always like this. We're okay. It's okay, but you're mad. What do you think about that? Yeah, I'm actually pretty ticked off right now. And you know what? I'm actually also ticked off because I just yelled at Johnny. And now I feel like a jerk and I feel pathetic. To be honest, I'm a little bit embarrassed at the moment. And they stop because they don't know where to go in that. Because they're the one who's worked up. Well, to the spouse who's communicating, who's more or less calm. Okay. Well, so you're mad. Okay. You know, try not to stand on your laurels. Try not to be prideful. Just accept it and... what do we do about it? And don't stop there, because actually just throwing on someone, what do we do about it? It's like, well, gee, I'm sure there's a million things, but I'm also really freaking stressed out right now. So what do we do about it? I don't know. I don't know what we do about it. So, well, you know, the best thing you can ask anytime a patient learns this, either because I've said it or they read it on some blog somewhere, of, I went to my wife yesterday and I said, do you want me to fix it or do you want me to listen? It's pure gold. It just works. Because it's like, you know what? I'm mad and I just need you to listen to me. Okay, well, why are you mad? Because my boss is a jerk and this thing happened yesterday and blah, 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 blah. And they can get it out. And you go, so this is what's happening. Yeah, that's what led to this. Yeah, and you could just go back and forth. And what you're actually going to find when you've held your spouse in mind, when you've reflected them back to themselves, when you've given them space to think, when you've shown them a more or less accurate sense of, I more or less get where you're coming from, they're probably going to calm down and they're probably going to feel better. And over the coming hours and days, things are actually hopefully going to go a little bit better, because it's actually really powerful when someone sees what we're feeling, what we're thinking, why we're doing what we do. And also when they don't judge it very harshly, when they go, yeah, okay, this is the thing that happened. Let's just move on. And I'm not dismissing it. I'm not saying it's unimportant, but I'm also not saying we have to dwell. I'm not getting angry with you. So going back to what happened in childhood, of the toddler's mad and he's kicking things and he's throwing his Duplos across the room. And you go, oh, Jimmy, you're so mad right now. It's okay. Come here. Let me give you a hug. Let me just hold you. Oh, you're going to fight me there for a second. Okay. Well, I'm going to pick you up and I'm going to put you over here because I don't want you throwing that at your brother. And I'm going to give you a second to think. So I'm showing you, I see what's going on inside of you. But I'm also saying, I'm not mad. I'm not losing it. We're actually safe right now. And you're safe right now. So that child can now calm down. That child can feel a whole heck of a lot better. And you can get back to living. It's the same thing with a spouse. You show them that. That I see you, and I'm not judging you, and I don't hate you. And even if I am feeling the same thing, I can keep it together long enough that we can get back to just living our life. Everyone's gonna calm down quite a bit. And this is also important for the positive things. We don't just need mirrored to us the negative things, the fights. You know, one spouse is super happy. It's probably best to play into their cards, not into the cards of the spouse who's really angry and upset at the moment, because you can only do so much there. If your wife comes home from the store and, well, she was gone, the children do what children do to men, and they've trashed the house, and one of them kicked you, and someone peed on the floor, and just everything's turning into a mess, and they've been awful, and you're spun up, and she's happy. If you can calm down for a second, take a couple breaths, just go, kids are crazy, take them for 2 minutes and I'll come back. Whatever it takes, when you come back and go, you seem like you're in a really good mood. You just went to the store, what's up? You know, I was glad you took the kids and I'm glad I finally got the grocery shopping done. And you know, actually, I've just actually been having a really great day. Things are going really well. Awesome, okay. You seem kind of stressed right now. Yeah, the kids have been a little bit crazy. Like, you know, if you play into the positive person, they can give you the positivity right back. But if instead you're fuming and you're starting to get a little bit like the toddler and you're not wanting to reflect, you're wanting to be coddled and to be seen and to have someone else take care of you. Well, how's the happy spouse going to be? They're not going to go, all right, let's get right to this. This is a great opportunity for us to help each other. They're going to have to come down to your level first. And they're probably not going to so easily bounce back to the level they were at before. It's just how it works. It's a lot harder to bounce back. So if there can be a sense of someone's happy, that's what a tremendous resource to have in the family. Wow, someone's happy. We could use that. We could work with that. This is great. Play into their hand. They could feed you because they're doing great. Next thing you know, hopefully, maybe you don't even get to feeling great, but you don't want to yell at the kids anymore. You don't want to kick the cat. Things are a little bit better. And then, you know, the day ends and you start talking about what happened in the day. You start talking about the things you saw and the things you enjoyed and the things that didn't go well, the things you thought about. Maybe your spouse is curious, why did you do that thing? Well, now you actually have the seeds, not just for problem solving, but for a really enjoyable, intimate moment. And this is actually what mentalization does. It's what a parent and child can do together. It's what two spouses can do together. When I can really hold you in mind, hold myself in mind, and we can come and share that in the moment, that's what intimacy is. That's what closeness is. Insecure attachments, high-charged anxiety situations, we don't tend to experience very good, healthy intimacy in that moment. We might get a lot of butterflies, we might get a lot of good feelings. There's a reason why a lot of celebrities, you know, on a very difficult filming, marry each other right afterwards and then divorce 6 months later. It can lead to some supercharged feelings, but that's actually not closeness. That's not intimacy. That's just a lot of stuff happening inside of you and inside of them. It's just chemistry. But real closeness is a capacity for people to see each other, to recognize each other, to know each other, to be patient with each other, to spend time with each other in a way that brings about a sense of mutual enjoyment, also mutual sorrow, because family members die, people get sick, things are hard. A mutual sense of, we're going to get through this, though. That's what we want to see in a marriage. That's where, you know, any couple would, I think, ideally want to be. We can do this. We can be close. And a lot of things can get in the way of that. And, you know, these little strategies, to kind of sum up, you know, start with your own reflection, start with the I statements, avoid the absolutes, be really reflective, and then shut up and let the other person talk. And then keep the conversation going as best you can. That's not going to fix things if things are bad. But it's going to actually allow things to get a whole lot better. Because even if you get it wrong, if you haven't really noticed where your spouse is really coming from, that's fine. Because if you can step back into this reflective mode, you can also not be so worked up that you can't take their correction. Okay, you're sad. You're not mad. Sorry, I was wrong. Okay. That's really just it. It's pretty simple. So, like I said, it's not a one-size-fits-all, is going to solve all your problems, panacea kind of thing. But it's a nice step to get you going again. Your car's running short on oil. It's starting to heat up. You put more oil in the car. But you don't just then go driving around merrily. You then change the oil because there's still a lot of nasty stuff in there. But you put the oil in first. You don't just drive around till the car catches fire. You do something about it. That's what this is. This is a way to say, let's get back on track. Let's start thinking and feeling and doing things together again. And then we'll figure it out. And the figuring it out might take hours. It might take years. It is what it is. But you can accept it when there's a sense of, I'm going to be received by the other person and I'm going to receive them. Because essentially, what is that? Like, what do we long for as human beings? We want to understand and we want to be understood. We want to love and we want to be loved. This is what this is. It's loving your spouse and them receiving the love and them giving the love back to you and you being understood and them being understood. It's meeting our most essential needs. And we can then work with that. It's a lot of great material, actually, to work with. So, yeah, that's my talk. That's what I had to say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My question has to do with Aristotle and Thomas, since you brought mm-hmm. those guys up in the beginning. So they have this really strong doctrine about habit. Mm-hmm. So what you've just suggested is some way to maybe start a new habit.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how hard that is to do?
Yeah. It depends where we're starting from. You take a couple and both of them are pretty securely attached, and yeah, it's actually not super hard.
How about one's really securely attached and one's not? Or vice versa.
That doesn't happen too often. Not usual. Birds of a feather and all that kind of thing. Usually what you actually end up getting is an anxious person and an avoidant person, and they chase each other. And one's hot and the other's cold. And the cold one wants to go to the hot one to get warm, but then the other one's too hot, so they run away. And the hot one wants to cool down, so they go to the other one, but it's too cold and it's icy and they're not getting their needs, so then they run away. And they go like this. And it doesn't work. And that kind of thing, it takes constantly going back to the basics over and over and over again. And it's probably going to take years. And it's probably going to be growing. And it's going to be hard. And there's going to be tears. And it's not going to be easy. So, yeah. Talking about the habit formation, this is the long game. Unless one of you is going to check out early, you're in it for the long term. So, you might as well play the long game, because what else have you got?
Yeah. Regarding the situation you just described of the people who are chasing one another and essentially running a vicious circle of the one individual is in need, but the other is in need of space. Mm-hmm. Are there any more particular things that they might do beyond the general statements, because it seems like there's a more fundamental issue that needs to be resolved, because the person who wants to be seen and mirrored is not in a position to be seen and mirrored, because what the other person wants in order to mm-hmm. be seen and mirrored himself or herself is to run away and not be seen and mirrored mm-hmm. in the first place. So it seems like there's something even more fundamental there that needs to be addressed rather than what you described is that even the fundamental steps. I don't even know how you would start bringing something like a vicious cycle.
I think if you can start with a conversation like this, you can come at a topic of, you know I need to get away sometimes. You know I get worked up. And if I don't get away, I'm actually going to get worked up even more, and it's not going to help either of us. But I also know that you need me to be around. And so I've seen myself, I've seen you. Now let's do something about it. What can we do? What can we do to make this happen? When can I get away enough that I can recharge my batteries and then I can come back to you? I know what you want. I know this isn't perfect, but I'm not going to be able to give you what you want until I've gotten quiet and calm first, because I can't. And that's just the first of the conversations. And you're going to screw up. And the spouse who tends to go away is still going to go away too much. The spouse who tends to chase is still going to chase and ask too much. But again, we're playing the long game. Keep having the conversation. Keep trying to reflect each other. Keep trying to reflect yourself and have these conversations where, here's where I'm at. Here's what I think I need. I'm also seeing what you need. What can we do about it? Maybe it's what can we do about it right now, or what can we do about it over the next few weeks? Is there a general plan we can hit on? Maybe life's not calm enough right now for a general plan, so let's just hash it out as we go. And kind of to bring up the idea of habits, that's what you're doing. You're very slowly ingraining habits of, rather than fighting each other, rather than playing this game of chase, there's a turning back to each other and figuring it out together. What can we actually do together that might work? And you do that over and over and over again. And, you know, to relate it to therapy, which is, you know, where I'm most familiar with dealing with this, it takes a long time. People come with a problem, and the first 6 months is getting to know somebody. You know, everyone wants to be fixed in therapy within a few weeks. It doesn't work that way. The first 6 months is literally getting a general sense of what's at play and gaining enough trust that you'll actually now tell me what's really wrong, and you'll start showing me what's really wrong. The next 6 months or after that are for you to start repeating the same patterns that you do with everyone else with me. Except the difference is we're going to go, let's stop and look at that for a minute. I'm not going to judge it, but you just chewed me out and what I said didn't seem like it was that bad. So tell me what just happened here. And that takes a really long time. There is no just, you know, I've made this intervention, I've made some perfect interpretation, or I've given you some guide of what you can do, and the patient comes back and goes, it's wonderful, I'm fixed. If they do that, it's like, yeah, good luck. It's going to take years. It's going to take hundreds of times of repeating the same thing over and over and over again, and it's going to be nauseating, but you're going to do it.
It seems to imply that everybody has the same capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can both rise together to the same capacity, the same level, which makes sense with our faith in a way, but with observation and human nature, it doesn't seem to be true. But do you agree that that's what you're really saying, is that everybody has this equal capacity to love and be loved, to reflect the other and mirror the other, to mentalize, etc., etc.?
No. I mean, if you take... I was having a conversation about this before we started. If you take the kids who are in these Soviet orphanages, who there's 3 nurses to 100 babies, they are forever impacted. They will never learn to love with feeling. They are a little bit feral, and they will always be feral. They can gain an intellectual conception of what it might mean to love, but it's never going to go beyond that. The moment has been missed. But... I don't think anyone here, it doesn't look like any of you grew up in an orphanage in Romania, thank God. So there's more to work with. Some couples are going to have more to work with. Some are going to have less. You know, usually when there's, say, a personality disorder, there's a good chance that both of the couples have a personality disorder. And that's not a judgment. This isn't the end of the world. But it does mean that capacity to reflect and communicate is going to be a lot less. But it's still possible because you still have emotions, you still have thoughts, you still have motivations, and you have some capacity to reflect and think on them. And honestly, if you have a 70 IQ and higher, you can do this. If you actually have some capacity to feel what's happening inside of you and to reflect on it, this is possible. Some couples, because of intelligence or because they're so secure, or because they have actually a really great sense of what's going on inside of me and the situation around me, are going to excel at this. And sometimes it's going to be a little uneven in a marriage. But it's still doable. And I honestly see people who... I work with personality disorders a lot, actually. And people learn. People figure it out. People get better at it. Also, a great thing that can happen is people become more secure over time. And sometimes people actually just simply become secure over time. They develop that secure attachment in later ages.
Is this the same thing as EQ? Is this all related that way, or is that just a name?
It's emotional intelligence. So sort of, you know, you have IQ, intelligent quotient.
Okay.
Like women seem to have a higher EQ.
Yeah.
Right? Would you agree?
EQ is, it has something to do with it, but it's not quite enough. Yeah.
When you say, you know, secure attachments, can that be just with one person, or do you kind of have to have secure attachments with, like, many people in your life to be securely attached?
It can be with one person. It happens in therapy, it happens in good marriages, where when you can have a reliable person who can kind of get you, and who you can get to a certain level and you could play with that, you can become actually quite secure. And you might not be secure with everybody. And it might be somewhat environmental. For the person who hasn't always been secure, there's going to be times and places where they fall back on the old ways. And there's actually an adaptation to that. That's helpful because when you go back to go visit your parents, yeah, the thing that you developed in childhood, you developed for a reason and it works. So you're going to start making your spouse crazy for a weekend, but it's going to work for the general situation. And actually, if you kind of can accept each other in that, it's probably going to help guide you because that's actually what works in that environment. In times of anxiety, you're very likely to fall back. If things get to a certain point, But you'll gain a capacity not to have those go to such an extreme and to maintain this function to reflect a lot longer. So it can definitely be gained, this idea of earn secure. And once you get it with a person, it can then start to, you know, you get secure with your spouse, you can start to become more secure with your children, you can start to become more secure with your friends and your neighbors and your boss, and it starts to bear fruits. It's not always going to be perfect, but bears fruits.
Yeah. Is there a nice shortcut online, personality, what is my attachment style questionnaire?
Yeah.
It's in the latest issue of Teen Vogue.
It's a good issue. Hey, it's got Tay-Tay in it, too. There's a bunch of them online. They'll get you in the ballpark some of the time, maybe most of the time. Their descriptions are probably going to be meh. Honestly, if you just pick up a good psych theory book, or honestly, just go to Wikipedia and read what the different styles are and what different thinkers have thought about those styles, and then just think about generally, what do I do? This isn't rocket science. This isn't like the deeper, darker parts of psych theory. It's something you can kind of just apply to yourself. So honestly, that's probably the best way. Go to Wikipedia, read it, and think which one matches me the best, and then go find a good book on it.
Do you have a book recommendation for someone who wants to dive more?
Yeah, actually, this guy Wallen, the book is making sure I get the order. Actually, it doesn't matter if I get the order right in the title, because it actually shows up either way, because I get it wrong all the time. It's Attachment and Psychotherapy, and it's a textbook for clinicians in the back of the book, but the front of the book is all about attachment styles and reflective functioning, mentalization, what these things look like in childhood, what they tend to look like in marriages and in adulthood and adult relationships. So the first half of that book is really accessible. None of it's, you don't have to know a plethora of psych theory. It's really a fantastic primer on all those. So,
how does codependence fit?
It depends even...
In this attachment idea.
Yeah.
It sounds like you could be securely attached to your spouse, maybe too securely.
Mm-hmm. Codependence, usually when you get two very anxious people together, and they're both looking for the same thing, and they're both never completely satisfied, but they keep looking at it from each other, or looking to get it from each other, and so that's it. They just keep spinning together, and they become more enmeshed over time, because sometimes they'll actually get it, and they can really get the other person, and the other person will give it to them, and so they tend to become very needy and clingy, and then it gets harder to kind of step back where you can actually reflect again, because reflecting takes a little bit of distance. It takes a little bit of detachment. When your spouse is really going through it, you got to step back far enough that you're not going through it with them in the sense of having the same experience. Codependents can't do that. Not very easily, not very often. They're in it together. They're too intertwined. And that neediness is what funnels the relationship.
And how does God fit in all this and your relationship with him?
Yeah. There is a guy, Peter Martin, out in Nebraska, and he has done a lot of research in this. And what he's found is your attachment style in childhood, especially to your father, actually says a lot about how you tend to see God. This isn't 100%, but more times than not, it's actually a pretty good gauge. So if you're anxiously attached to your father, you're probably going to go chasing after God, looking for a sense of, God, why won't you show me? Like, why won't you tell me if I'm doing a good enough job? Why aren't you helping me? Why aren't you showing me the sign? If you're more avoidant, I know I should pray right now. And before you've even completed that thought, you've pulled out your phone and you're, because you don't want to complete that thought. You want to get away from the relationship as fast as possible. Meanwhile, if you're pretty securely attached, you're going to come to God and go, here's what's going on. You're going to pray and you're going to expect things. And you're going to have a sense that sometimes God isn't going to give you what you want. And sometimes he is. And sometimes things are going to be clear. And sometimes they're not, because that's just how relationships work. None of them are perfect. So it says a lot, actually. Yeah. Any other questions or anything?
So old dads versus young dads raising kids.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed that's generally easier or harder for the child to form secure attachment, get the kinds of mirroring and attention and mentalization that's needed?
There's pros and cons to both. Young dads can be a little more attentive, they can be a little more energetic, but they're usually starting their careers, they're usually a lot more preoccupied with other things besides the kids. Older dads, you know, they can relax. They've gained a sense of themselves, they've been through it, they're hopefully in a better place in their careers, things are hopefully pretty stable. Old dads do actually have a little bit of a step up oftentimes, because there's a lot more room to step back and go, I'm just going to watch this kid. And I don't have anything to prove because I've already proved it, and I'm not preoccupied because I've got my stuff in order. I'm just going to relax and enjoy this moment. It's a lot harder to relax and enjoy this moment when it's like, I'm not sure how the business is doing right now, and I'm not sure where the next paycheck's going to come in, or gosh, I'm not making enough money, or I'm really under the thumb at work. Especially when you think of like Catholic families where oftentimes there is one income, and that puts a tremendous amount of stress as you're starting a career, and that also necessitates being away from the family more. And for a lot of dads, that also leads to feeling a lot more guilty. But instead of that guilt going, gosh, I wish I could be with the kids more. And then when you're with the kids, you're not with the kids. You're worried about the guilt and what you're not doing. And that's hard. When you can distance yourself from that and get not secure in the attachment sense, but more secure in your finances and in your career and in who you are and what you like. And it's a lot easier to just take a step back. It's why grandparents are chill. They've been through it. They don't have anything to prove anymore. And honestly, things are just gonna, you know, grandkids gonna be okay. I'm okay. We can work with this. So yeah, there's quite an edge there. Yeah. All right.
Questions?
Well, thanks, y'all.
Thank you. Thank you.